This is the Fall Line. This week, we bring you our final installment in the story of Carolyn DeFord. Her story itself certainly isn't over, and her work, both online and in the world, continues today. But we'll bring you up to the present day in the search for her missing mother, Leona LeClaire Kinsey, and how Carolyn became an advocate for missing and murdered Indigenous people in the U.S. and beyond. After Leona's disappearance in 1999, news coverage was spotty. It was largely due to Carolyn's efforts that her name recurs in the archives at all. Before Carolyn's own advocacy began, recorded by journalists in her push for coverage and political address of the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the United States, there were a few articles around the time of her mother's disappearance. Then, in 2008, the Le Grand Observer published an article, Remembering Leona. The piece served as both a retrospective on Leona's disappearance and as a report on the memorial held by her friends and family on October 25th. It was exactly 9 years to the day since she had vanished. Per the Observer, the event was both a ceremony to mark Leona's life and designed to draw attention to her case, to remind people that her friends and family had never stopped looking. And that, further, they were convinced that people in town had to know something about her disappearance. Carolyn was quoted as saying, "When I was a kid growing up here, I couldn't sneak out of the house to go skating or whatever without the whole town knowing about it. It's hard to understand how something like this can happen and nobody knows anything." Carolyn, who was working and living in Georgia, had to participate by phone. A second Observer article, published November 3rd, quoted some of the remarks Carolyn sent to be read aloud at the memorial. She wrote, 3,289 days, and not one goes by that I don't miss my mother. 9 years later, I am still crying over the loss, and I know the tears are real because they come from the inside out. Carolyn told us she was speaking directly to Leona with those words. When she was little, her mom would sometimes tell her to stop crying if they weren't real tears. Carolyn wrote that, quote, "Those grieving tears were the kind I couldn't control or stop. They just kept coming." At that time, a new detective had been assigned to Leona's case, someone familiar with her disappearance, but who had not been in charge of it at the time. The hope for rekindling of news coverage and public interest, though, it didn't come. Carolyn herself would be the impetus for her mother's name making a reemergence into the media, linked with a dawning public awareness of the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the U.S. It would be several more years before Carolyn made this work her primary focus, when the pieces came together in 2015. She discussed it with Brooke this spring during their final interview.
I was working at Aerotech under Allegis Group, which is a global staffing and recruiting firm. And it was a big, you know, a big corporation and a corporate job. And I was doing really well. My personality wasn't fit for it. Being an introvert, it was really hard for me to step outside of my comfort zone in some of those forums and venues and stuff. But I had a career there and I could have gone further. But I woke up one day and I felt like the two roads diverged in the woods and I took the one less traveled. There's two roads and I'm deep on the wrong one and I don't know how to get to that one. I'm on the wrong path. I'm not where I'm supposed to be right now. And I kind of had like a midlife crisis or something. I made a plan and I put in a 30-day notice to give myself a little time to figure something out and to give them time to find a replacement. And I didn't have a plan. I never really came up with one. I just thought, well, it'll work out. You know, I'll make it. I have same things to sell and I can do this and I can get a job doing that if I have to. And I took about 6 weeks off and I applied for several different jobs all over, you know, our county. And I applied and interviewed for two or three different jobs for the Puyallup tribe. And I kept getting, you know, thank you for applying. We've you know, chosen a candidate. Please continue to keep us in mind for a few, you know, further opportunities. And I was just like, this sucks. You know, I just want to work for the tribe. I just want to work for the tribe because they had excellent benefits. And I just felt like that's where I was supposed, where I needed to be. And then I got a call on my birthday, or right before my birthday, that they had a position open. It was temporary and it was an emergency hire, meaning like somebody had gotten sick or somebody had gotten fired or somebody quit or something, and they needed to fill this space immediately. And it was just an administrative assistant in the children's services program. And Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, it was a drastic pay cut, but it was from my previous job, but it was more than I was making doing nothing, you know. So I took it thinking I'd get my foot in the door, and I started on my birthday. And children's services, I was imagining it to be like helping kids with their activities program and after school things and daycare and, I don't know, children services for children. I learned a lot about our culture. You know, I wasn't really raised within the tribal community, and so I didn't know much of our tribal history, and I didn't know any etiquette or traditions or, you know, culture. And I had really beautiful and gracious mentors there that taught me things and didn't make me feel like I wasn't Indian enough. You know, that's a big problem with people. I learned a lot of lessons there, but I learned about historical trauma, and I learned about the effects of trauma, and I learned that my mom did the best she could with what she knew how to do. That was really powerful for me to really understand. You know, I had forgiven her. You know, she'd called me in my dreams and said she was sorry, and I was sorry too, but, and I'd forgiven, you know, I had that forgiveness, but I didn't really understand that she did the best that she knew how to do. And I started putting things together about, you know, her experiences that I seen as a child, but didn't understand, you know, domestic violence and assaults and poverty and just all of these things that she experienced when she was young. And while I was working there, that was probably 2016. I, by chance, somehow, for some reason, I used to Google missing persons, missing persons groups, missing persons support. You know, I used to just kind of periodically every couple months Google and see what was out there, you know, see what was going on and if there was anything that would help me. And I came across this proposal, or the first proclamation in the United States to declare May 5th as National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. And I read about that and, you know, how it was in honor of Hannah Harris, and you know, how it was introduced on the day that Roylynn Ride's horse was found murdered, and how prominent this issue is in our country. I'd heard about it in Canada, you know, probably since 2007. And I was just already very kind of comforted and relieved that Canada was acknowledging missing and murdered Indigenous women across North America. And when I was hearing about that, I thought, oh my God, that's my mom. You know, that's us. And I read this proclamation where Obama was signing this resolution for the Day of Awareness. And I went home and was thinking, gosh, we should acknowledge that. Like, that's big. We should acknowledge that. And I wrote a letter to tribal council and told them my story, and, well, very vaguely, and asked for permission to acknowledge May 5th as a National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women on the Puyallup Reservation. And what I wanted to do was hang signs and red dresses and an article in the paper and have everybody wear red. They gave me their blessing. And it was kind of, I had an overwhelming response of support from the whole community. And I had, about 2 weeks before that, I had reached out to Deborah Shipman at MMIW USA and Janet Franson at Lost and Missing in Indian Country. and was talking to them about kind of numbers and what's happening, like why, where are they going, what's happening to them, what are the causes, you know, and trying to really understand it. And everything that came up, I was like, you know, you could put a check mark of risk factors and indicators, and my family met every one of them. And they were probably my first real mentors that got me through that, you know. And so we acknowledged this day of awareness kind of together and in my community, and it was really healing to do all that, to do it for her the first time, you know, that her people knew who she was. She mattered. And then in the next 3 or 4 months, I had talked to our domestic violence program right before that first May 5th and got their blessing as well, because, you know, domestic violence is such a huge part of what happens to our women. And they partnered with me and helped me hang dresses and were really supportive through that. About 2 months later, the director from the domestic violence program, we were in a couple different groups together and stuff, and she asked me one day, "What do you do over there? What's your job?" And I said, "I'm an administrative assistant." And she's like, Oh, okay. A couple months went by like that, and then I seen a job posting in the paper that they were hiring a senior administrative assistant to be the assistant to the director. She's not shy. You know, she reminded me of my auntie, my mom's sister, except my auntie's a little more reserved. But spiritually, she felt like my auntie's energy. And we were sitting down one day at Culture, and she said, "Did you see my job in the paper?" And I said, "Yeah." And she's like, "Well, are you going to apply for it?" And I said, "No, you know, no." And she's like, "Why not?" And I was like, "I love my job." And she's like, "You'd love this one too." And I was like, "I probably would, but I really love my job." And she's like, "Well, think about it. You'd love this one too." And I was like, "I will, you know." And so I was driving home and I called my boyfriend to tell him, you know, like, she asked me if I applied for that job, and no, you know. And he's like, "Well, did you look at it?" And I said, "Yeah, I went back to the office and looked at it." And he said, "Well, why aren't you going to apply for it?" And I said, "Well, one, it says you have to have experience in domestic violence, and I don't have any DV. It says either lived or professional experience in domestic violence." I said, "I don't have any experience in domestic violence." And he's like, "What? What are you talking about? Like this and this?" So he starts pointing up these things that we had talked about it about previous relationships with both of us, you know, and things that were domestic violence in past relationships. And he's like, you've lived domestic violence. This was DV and this was DV and this was DV. And every adult relationship that I had had up until that point had a component of domestic violence. If it wasn't physical abuse, it was emotional and psychological. And he's like, those are domestic violence. And I said, "They never hit me." And he's like, "They shoved you. They spit on you. They slapped you. They, you know," all, he's like naming these things, you know, all of these horrible things that had happened, you know, threw you down the stairs, and they, you know, that's domestic violence. And I was like, "But they didn't hit me." And he's like, "It doesn't matter." He's like, "Apply, just think about it, apply." And I was like, "Well, it closes tomorrow." And he's like, "Well, turn your application in and think about it. Like, if you turn your application in, then you can just think about it." And I said, "Okay." You know, so I turned in my application like 10 minutes till the deadline the next day. And I didn't tell my boss at Children's Services. And she's such a gracious, beautiful person, you know, and I didn't want to leave her. And I didn't want to tell her that I was even considering it or playing with it, you know. And I got called to interview, and I went and interviewed on my lunch break, and the interview was easy. Like, I didn't care if I got the job, I guess was why it was easy, you know. And they called me the next day and asked, you know, to fill out the background check paperwork, and I filled it out, and then I waited like 5 days to turn it in, and they're like, "Carolyn, are you going to turn it in?" And I was like, "Yes, okay, you know." And they're like, "We need it now, you know, we got to get this going now." And I was like, "Okay." So I waited until they were almost mad at me to turn in my background paperwork, and They offered me the job and I said, can I think about it? And they said, okay, well, you know, we'll call you back on Friday. And Friday rolls around and they called me back and I said, can I have till 5? I didn't know, you know, and I, my boss came into my office and she's like, how are you doing? And I was like, well, I've got a big decision to make and I don't know what to do, you know? And she's like, what is it? What's going on? You know? And I started crying and I said, I applied for the administrative assistant position at Domestic Violence and they offered me the job and I don't know what to do, you know? And she's like, Carolyn, who are you to question when your ancestors and creator opened doors for you? Who are you to question? And I was like, but I don't want to leave you. I told her, I don't want to leave you. And she said, we're still in the same company. We'll still see each other. We'll still partner on things. You know, she's like, I don't want you to go and I don't want to encourage you to go, but who are you to question when creator opens doors for you? She said, it's not my job to hold you, you know, to steer you or hold you back. You do what you feel is right. You know, you make that decision, but these things don't happen on accident. And I was like, I kind of just said, okay. And so they called back and said, well, have you made a decision? And I was like, well, okay, I'll take it. I started in July and I just kind of shadowed under my director for a while and learned a lot about DV and sexual assault and trauma again, you know, and on another level, and not just trauma as how it affects, you know, children or parenting, but how it affects us in general. And October rolled around and it was Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And she had me plan our candlelight vigil. And we have, at the time we had 7 silent witnesses. And those are like big red silhouettes of women that have been dedicated to women in our community who have been missing or murdered, some due to domestic violence. And they each have a story. And so she asked if I wanted to dedicate one to my mom. And I was like, yeah. I didn't even really think about how that would affect me. You know, I just, and my cousin was murdered in 2002. And I asked if we could also dedicate one to my cousin. And she said, of course, you know, so we made 2 silent witnesses. They're to these giant plywood, you know, cutouts, and we painted them, and I wrote my mom's story and my cousin wrote her sister's story, and we're getting ready for the vigil. And I've been so busy for like 3 weeks that I haven't slowed down to think about anything. And everybody's loading up to head to the location. And my boss tells me, hold on, you know, I want to talk to you for a second. And she sits down and she's like, how are you doing? And I start bawling. I was like, I haven't cried all day. Now I'm not going to stop. Thanks. And she's like, your mom is proud of you. And I said, I hope so. And she says, she is. And she's here right now. And I was like, you think so? And she's like, I know she is. And then she gave me a hug and we went to the event and we did it. And then May 5th rolled around again and we did May 5th. And then, you know, May 5th rolled around again and we did May 5th. And it was really organic. Like, I feel like I just, every morning on my way to work, that's my quiet time. And I would just pray, you know, to Creator and my ancestors to guide me and help me see my path. And if I don't see it, give me the gentle nudge and let me do, you know, help me to do what it is I'm here to do. And whatever that is, help me see it, you know, help me do it. And literally, like, things just happen. I feel like I don't even work. It's just, things just happen. I was kind of, you know, supporting families in our community and talking to people who were coming forward with their stories about their loved ones that they've never shared before, and saying that, you know, thank you for doing this. We need this. We need to talk about this. We need to, you know, it feels good to remember her, you know, and seeing how that, the feedback I was getting from other families and how many families in our community had been affected and lost people. And our tribal council started, you know, legislation and tribal issues started really looking at MMIW a lot closer. What do our families need? And so I kind of started talking to our tribal council more about those kind of things. And I was kind of designated our MMIP advocate. And people just started calling me to help them, you know, make a poster, tell me what to do, what can I do, what resources are out there, what haven't I done yet, you know, or just to talk, sometimes just to talk. It's one of the scariest, most helpless feelings with every gruesome vision of what is happening to your loved one going through your head. And just to have somebody to talk to at 2 a.m. or whenever is priceless. It just kind of happened. You know, I started getting asked to tell my story. I started getting asked to tell my mom's story, and I started getting asked to come talk about the issue. Where did it start? What does it come from? What are the causes? Why is this happening? What can we do? And I started being called to do presentations with other organizations and within our community and outside our community. Sometimes I would just get called to come speak at rallies that were talking about different social justice issues. And they would ask me to come talk about missing and murdered Indigenous people. Sometimes it was free. Sometimes it was an honorarium. It didn't matter to me. You know, I never did it for the money. What was the most rewarding is, you know, the families that come up afterwards and say, I know how that feels, or thank you. I never thought anybody understood what I was going through, or nobody ever understood what that was like. And thank you. You know, that was probably the most, that made it worth it, because I knew how lonely it is. I started looking at some of the issues, you know, deeper and talking about domestic violence prevention. And in those prayers one day, I just had this feeling like, we can talk about MMIW and make awareness, but we've got to stop it. And we can do that, you know, through domestic violence prevention and sexual assault prevention and awareness and putting programs in place, you know, with our children to learn about healthy relationships and teaching our kids safe boundaries and safe touch and bystander interventions and chemical dependency support and culture, you know, how preventive and amazing culture is in that healing. And so I started looking a little bit more at the prevention side of things and seeing the connection between human trafficking and missing and murdered. And I'd always seen these, you know, when I'm sharing posters, I'd always seen people that I wondered if they had been trafficked, but I hadn't made the connection in my head yet. And I went to a conference in Washington, D.C., and the keynote speaker talked about human trafficking. And she just by chance happened to, I'm a conference geek and I sit in the front row every time like a big nerd. I want to see, you know. The presenter had sat by me and I noticed that she had we're like a Coast Salish people. So we don't have like the North Dakota, you know, and Plains kind of tribal motifs. Everything here is very, I don't know how to explain, Coast Salish, kind of like Alaskan art. And she had a cup with Coast Salish design on it. And I was like, I wonder where she got that, you know? And when she introduced herself, she said she was from Olympia. And Olympia, I live like 15 minutes away from Olympia. And I was like, wow, you know, she lives close to me. And so I went to the breakout session later that day that she was presenting in, and I asked several questions about human trafficking and was there a connection to missing and murdered and what was it and what can we do and how prevalent is it and how many of our missing do you think are trafficked? And gosh, we gotta find those trafficked people, because, you know, your life expectancy in the life. You know, if you're being trafficked, your life expectancy is 7 years or less on average. And that's where, you know, I just knew that was something that we had to start bringing more attention to. So I started talking about it at work, and I started talking about it with my tribal council, and I started sharing information on social media and just as me, you know, not necessarily as my job.
What's really amazing to me is that you didn't stop on the surface. You were looking for the root, starting with your mom's story and starting with all the missing and murdered people in your community.
It's funny, you know, that they say do the job you love and it won't be work, right? And the things that I did as far as MMIW outreach and support or advocacy, that was my self-care. Like, that's what I did in my free time because it made me feel good. And it's turned into every aspect of my life, except for my kids are very detached from it. I think it's probably affected my older son more than he's willing to admit. You know, he was old enough to remember my mom and see me struggle through that and stuff. I was mentoring with MMIW USA, and I was an admin on their Facebook page, and I was learning a lot about, you know, what families need and what they're requesting, and just, you know, kind of everything that I knew, you know, everything that I needed. When I was going through different databases, like the Polyclass Foundation and the Q Center for Missing People and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and NAMIS, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, I was kind of seeing more men. And I was like, gosh, you know, like 65% of our missing people that are reported are men. And I prayed about it. And my praying isn't like down on my hands and knees and praying. It's that I'm driving in my car and I say, Creator, Ancestor, my ancestors, grandfather, please guide me. Please help me to do what is needed. Keep me on my path. Show me what to do. I had a dream that I'm standing outside the woods and I can see my mom in the trees, and behind her, there's trees as far back as I can. And behind her, I see all of these other women. I just know that there are other missing and murdered Indigenous women. They're my mom's friends. And I felt like when I was young, my mom went to jail. And when she got out of jail, she said, I kind of miss my friends in jail. She kind of missed her cellmates, and she'd become friends with them. And I felt that feeling for her with those women in the trees. And they were as far back as I could see. And I woke up and I thought, gosh, that was vivid. You know, I seen her. Nobody said anything. I just seen her, and I seen all the others, and they were healthy, you know, and beautiful. And I just felt that they all prayed for their children, their sons and their daughters. When they left, when they knew that they were leaving their bodies, they all prayed for their sons and their daughters. And I started talking about missing and murdered people, missing and murdered Indigenous people. And a couple of other groups were doing that. And I just kind of branched off a little bit and wanted to focus on supporting families, you know, just being what I needed when there was nothing. And so I made Missing and Murdered Native Americans, and I really don't love the name. I feel like it's triggering and ugly, but I was just up late one night throwing around a bunch of names, and that was how the issue was described in the legislation. And I thought if that's what it was going to be called in the states, that might align me in family searches as support. And now I'm like, gosh, I wish it was something else, because it's just, I get sick of saying murdered.
Have you thought about what you would rather it be if you could change it?
I've thought a few times. Everything has murdered in it. I like the acronym MMIWRC, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Relatives, and Children, because that would include everybody. It's kind of in line with some of our other Native American organizations. So the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center is NIWRC, and Minnesota Indigenous Women's Resource Center is MIWRC, and this would be MMIWRC. So I kind of like that connection, but it has murdered in it again. But if I just called it MMIWRC, anyway, I played with Gone But Not Forgotten, and it wasn't specific enough. So it just, it is what it is. And, you know, I never imagined that it would be what it is. And we don't do a lot of direct services. The other person who helps me with the page, her cousin went missing 12 years ago, and she's an elder. She's just really spiritual and uplifting and positive. And she messaged my page one day and said, how can I help? And I gave her homework because I didn't really trust anybody to help, you know, and at the time I had time to do it myself, you know. And she messaged me back and said, okay, I watched those videos. What else do I need to know? And we kind of talked a little bit about her experience and everything. And I made her an admin. We have a group where public can share their posts about missing in their community and their loved ones, you know, their missing loved ones, information on events or news or anything like that. And we get more engagement in the group and on the page. We get more engagement on Instagram than we do in either of them.
So are people sending you these cases, this information, and then you are able to share it?
A lot of them are things that people send us. People might post it in the group and say, please share. We go through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and NAMIS and find new and updated cases. We have a couple private groups where some of us who run different pages all kind of come together and talk about, like, hey, I have someone missing here who's suspected to be taken to Dallas, you know, and we have somebody in Texas that can kind of focus outreach down there, you know. And so there's probably about 7 of us across the country in this one group that kind of share with each other and brainstorm and try and find resources and just reach a further audience.
Can you talk about your understanding of what social media can do that traditional media cannot or doesn't when they're sharing a very active situation?
Media doesn't really like to share a lot of MMIW stuff. You know, there's not a lot of missing persons cases shared on the news or in the newspaper. Maybe a high profile one or one here and there sporadically, or one where the family is able to make a bunch of noise, or the person has a, you know, has a big name or holds status in the community. But for the most part, media kind of ignores the issue. And with social media, we can reach, gosh, you know, within 2 hours, we can reach 30,000 people. The problem with that, though, is like everybody or a lot of the folks who are in these pages and following these groups and stuff, like preaching to the choir, like we're there because it's affected our lives, or we're there because we're, you know, we're part of a tribal community. And, you know, when we're looking for missing, we may need to be looking outside of the tribal community. We've definitely found a lot of people through social media or been able to pinpoint a location of people through social media and kind of rally calls to action to get community involvement. For community to share posters, or, you know, I've put calls out to, like, if there's anybody that is free to hang posters this weekend, you know, message me and I will print the posters and mail them to you, you know. And some people are like, I can do it, you know, and I have a printer. But we found people through that, you know. Somebody was hanging posters in downtown Seattle for us last winter, fall. And 2 days after the posters were put up, the family member received a phone call that their loved one was in Seattle and seen her poster on a telephone pole and decided she better call home. You know, and statistically, I think, I can't remember what it is, but I was at a conference a couple years ago and they said, you know, over 90% of our missing people don't know they're missing. They don't know someone's looking for them.
Like you said, it can be a little bit difficult if you're trying to get the message out to the right people, but it really seems like social media is right there where you want to be to get it seen by people who might be able to make a difference.
And I always, you know, remind people, like, message your local news station and have all of your friends call and email and message your local news station, because the squeaky wheel, you know, and call your law enforcement, because most media won't share anything about missing people unless law enforcement requests it. And if you don't push law enforcement to request it, most of them aren't. And I think, you know, over the last year and a half, I've seen more and more law enforcement agencies sharing missing people through social media. So we follow a lot of law enforcement agency Facebook pages and get a lot of our information from there, because those ones haven't been put in a database yet. Sometimes they're just be on the lookout, you know, for this teenager. It's interesting to see how other agencies, you know, other law enforcement agencies and social service programs are also using social media for their outreach.
Have you talked much about geo-targeted Facebook ads?
We've done a couple. I haven't quite mastered it yet, but sometimes we'll pay for an ad if the case we've been working on for a while, or we don't get a budget. You know, we're volunteers, so if I pay for something, it comes out of pocket, or I pay for it with speaking fees. And we've done a few, and sometimes I'll Google search, you know, outreach organizations and cities along. Like if somebody were to leave Olympia, I might Google the roads leaving Olympia and the cities along those routes, and then start joining groups in those cities and sharing it to those cities, or messaging the groups and pages in those cities and asking them to share it on their pages. And that's kind of, you know, how I've been trying to get around targeting a community without having to spend money on the ad.
Yes, exactly. It's a double-edged sword, because it's like hanging up posters in a few block radius if you can't get there physically. But on the other hand, it does cost money. And we've talked about geo-targeted ads on the show before and how impactful they could be with young people who are out and about scrolling social media. And all of a sudden, they look up from their phone and they see someone walk by that they just saw a few minutes ago a picture of on their phone.
Yeah, it has the potential to, you know, to really go far. We had a group of children that were a non-custodial parent abduction a couple of years ago, and we thought that the parent may have headed to a certain area. And so we started sharing in community groups in that area, and somebody messaged the page and said, I live in this complex, and the car in that picture with that license plate and those identifying marks is in my parking lot. I called the police. You're just like, oh my God, you know, you're kind of holding your breath until you hear more and until the family says found, you know. And sometimes we're specifically in contact with the family, and sometimes we're just resharing from their page. And I try to reshare rather than make a new post with the new picture, because if the family updates that post, then it updates on our page too. Where if I copy their picture and write my own write-up about it, when they're found, we don't know, you know.
Would you have any advice for listeners that we may have that have an interest in this area but don't have any experience?
Gosh, maybe if there's events in your area, if there's a rally, a vigil, go. If families are fundraising to pay for those ads, or sometimes they have to travel to claim their remains, or they have to pay for a billboard. If they're going to court, you know, you can't take signs into a courthouse, but you can rally outside with signs. You can wear a t-shirt in court. Sometimes families are fundraising to buy a t-shirt with their loved one's information on it, and then funding to travel to wherever court is. A lot of our families don't have extra money to do that. You know, they're already taking time off work and have gone through a lot of stress, and anything that can relieve that burden for them and kind of show them community support is priceless. You know, a donation on their GoFundMe with some kind words, sharing the poster. You know, how many people that work in convenience stores or grocery stores or gas stations or hotels or urgent care clinics come into contact with people who are missing and don't know it? You know, if you can put posters on your employee bulletin board, do it. If you can share it to your local community group where it's going to get outside of the, you know, that family's immediate circle, do it.
be compassionate and be careful of the language that we use. People say, well, they shouldn't have been wearing that, or they shouldn't have been out there, or why are we focusing on this when there is somebody who's not an addict that needs help? Runaways. Like, when you hear runaway, we don't get a whole lot of shares on runaway posts. But runaways are vulnerable and endangered youth because they're a child out there without a parent or a guardian to watch out for or be responsible for them. Bad guys target that. And so when you say runaway, your vision of that is this problem child who doesn't listen and doesn't follow rules and, you know, a delinquent kid who's in trouble, not necessarily a youth who is going through stuff that children shouldn't go through and running from it or was lured away. I hate posts that say runaway. I'll say missing and endangered youth, and I'll rewrite, you know, I'll share the direct post so that it updates, but I try to be really aware of that language because they're children, you know, even if they did run away, they need to be found. And there's so many times that while they're running, that they're taken advantage of or hurt, and it could be prevented if we took those runaways serious. You know, there's several cases of young girls who were trafficked when they ran or who were assaulted when they ran and found dead. Just our language is important. Just to be aware of that, you know, and the effects of trauma and how people cope. You know, like my mom coped with her trauma through self-medicating and in her addiction. As a kid, I didn't get that. You know, as a kid, I was just mad that she used. I was mad that the drugs were more important, that I didn't matter. I didn't understand the things that she had gone through and how much that hurt and haunted her. The drugs numbed it. There's a blog post somewhere. I Googled my mom's name a few days ago, and somebody commented something to the effect of, why are we sharing this one? So-and-so is missing, and her family isn't getting, you know, she's not getting any awareness or attention, and why are you focusing on this addict, you know, this drug user? And I was like, ouch, you know? I mean, I get it. I get how people don't know, you know, but it's still insensitive.
It's a lot more than insensitive. Yeah. It really sounds to me like the work that you do, of course, is healing to the people that you come into contact with, but at the same time is equally healing you. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking to a family this winter and was kind of able to put it into words. You know, they said, thank you so much. You know, we couldn't have, you know, we wouldn't have gotten through this without you. Thank you for the work you do. And I thought about it, and I always feel like no thanks necessary, you know, like don't thank me. I know that I would be grateful. So I don't say that, you know, I don't want to devalue their appreciation or, you know, anything like that. But I just say, it's an honor to walk with you on this journey. Thank you for trusting me. And it's been very healing for me and helped me find purpose in an experience that doesn't make any sense, you know, to find healing in something, to find purpose and healing in this experience when it's just an unexpected place to find healing in family, you know, like there's several MMIW families where, especially in our local community, where we're family. When there's an event for one of our families, we all go if we can. Or we all support somehow if we can. And you celebrate their successes and you share their frustrations and try and support each other in awareness and getting the word out and finding new resources. And nobody really knew what I meant when I said certain things, you know. And many of our other family members do, you know, because they can either put it into words where I couldn't, or you just know how they feel, you know. And before we had May 5th and, you know, we didn't have these opportunities to raise awareness for MMIW, it was always just there, you know, and May 5th has been healing for so many people, for the larger population to stop and acknowledge this issue.
that we never stop, you know, it's always in the front of you, you know, it's always there, and having community and people acknowledge it is, it feels good, but it's also been triggering. You know, last year when we couldn't gather and we couldn't get together, I didn't realize how much I missed being able to sing with other families or to hear other families' stories. Without it, you didn't know what you were missing.
We asked Carolyn what she'd like to share with the Fall Line audience. What action items our listeners could take with them? Here's what she sent us. Donate directly to families who are fighting for justice and who are searching. Donate to organizations like Sovereign Bodies Institute and MMIW USA who have 501c3 status and provide direct services. Learn about and address the intersections leading to missing and murdered Indigenous women and the causes that are making Native women particularly targeted. No matter our skills, hobbies, or career, we all have an opportunity and an obligation to make a difference. We can all make a difference in prevention and awareness of trafficking, domestic violence, sexual assault, substance abuse disorder, mental health, and homelessness to prevent missing and murdered relatives. You can also keep your eyes open, sharing posters, joining searches, etc. We need help getting posters out into non-Native communities too. Sometimes it's like we are preaching to the choir about these issues, and the folks with the platforms and the social circles to really make an impact aren't reached. Call on your city, work, groups, or community to request trainings or information sessions on missing and murdered Indigenous women and how to help. Fundraisers, we always, always need resources. Support families at events and rallies. I can't say how many times I'm invited to speak at or attend an event and told to bring my people. Sometimes if it's a high-profile event, people accept my invitations, but usually it's small and not glamorous, so my people are poster board signs. Carolyn's main point here, aside from supporting groups like SBI and MMIW USA, is to get local. And local can mean your digital world too. Seek out influencers and social media presences to highlight and share cases. Be sure to follow pages devoted to your state and share those cases. Show up to local events and follow accounts on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter so you know when they're happening. We want to thank Carolyn DeFord for sharing her story and her mother's story with us. If you have any information in the disappearance of Leona LeClaire Kenzie, please call the LeGrand Police Department at 541-963-1017. There is a $10,000 reward in this case. The Fall Line will be going on a short summer hiatus until July 14th. We have some updates and surprises dropping in our feed over the break, so keep an eye out for those. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Jessica Ann. Family and law enforcement interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced and engineered by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to private investigations for the missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of private investigators.